does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it
all. It's a Friday in Indianapolis. How are you? My name is Jake Query. Jimmy Cook, the other voice you hear on this program. Eddie Garrison is our Captain James Tiberius Kirk. He's flying the Starship Enterprise for us today. Joining us now on the program, you hear him every morning with Andy Sweeney, the wake-up call with KB and Andy, and then on Fridays on this show. By the way, our Feel Good Friday coming up at 2:30 today, a story about this guy's favorite sport, talking about Kevin Bowen. Kevin, I'll get right to this question off the top. Do you believe, doesn't really matter now, but do you believe that the Colts in fact were looking to and making frantic phone calls to move up in round number one before they selected at 15?
I do, and I think Atlanta's infatuation, I guess, with drafting Michael Penix at number eight was the reason why it probably didn't happen. And, you know, if you want to play out Roma Dunes, they went 9 to the Bears, then, you know, reading a little tea leaves, that's where you would think. I actually just tweeted out quotes from Ballard of past drafts, because I've gotten this question, you know, a lot in the last 12 hours or so. Well, Ballard says that after every draft. He just wants you to think that he was trading up. I mean, I pulled quotes from last year's draft. I pulled quotes from 2020 when everybody thought they were trading up to take Jordan Love, or trading back into round one, and the quotes are totally different than what he had to say last night. So, yeah, I thought there was some legit interest there. I had even heard a little Brock Bowers, you know, obviously just two picks. And I think what you saw unfold in the first 14 picks told you everything you needed to know. Not a single team traded outside of a one-pick swap between Minnesota and New York. I mean, that's it. I mean, look at any draft history. You never see that, but you saw it last night.
Were you, Kevin, the pick itself, I guess your overall reaction to Indianapolis' selection?
Yeah, I had just kind of written him off the board because of medicals. And, you know, oftentimes I tend to, like, do that during the draft just because, A, I have no idea what the medical background really is on these guys, just as certainly you don't get anywhere near that type of access. And I was really struck by a Ballard quote from Friday, last Friday, when Bob Kravis said, I asked him a great question about draft philosophy and how that's changed, if at all, for him. And he reluctantly got to this part of his answer and saying, we still want the unique traits, a.k.a. all those testing numbers. And Jake, you and I have certainly joked about the RAS score. But then he admitted, you know, there's times where we probably need to find a little bit more substance on the tape. And when I heard that, I was like, whew, that's quite the admittance for Ballard. Now, actions will ultimately speak. Well, you want substance on tape? That's exactly what Latu is. And he's not the crazy RAS athlete that they have grown accustomed to taking on a routine basis. So, you know, when you started to kind of read into some of that stuff, the Danielle Hunter, you know, I've always been a big fan of going after an edge rusher. It started to make a little bit more sense.
Kevin Bowen is our guest. You hear him on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy weekdays 7 to 10 a.m. on these very airwaves. Of course, you can follow him on Twitter at KBowen1070 for continued draft coverage and reaction throughout the weekend. Kevin, I'm not a fan necessarily of the positional selection. I have no problem with Latu. I think that what Ballard said, especially about stuff on tape that pops with him, most notably that USC game, what he's able to do with Caleb Williams is impressive. I think he has numbers. He might even be able to be a good edge rusher in this league. But going into this season, when there's so much made of Anthony Richardson and his development, and I'm not even talking about they should have gone offense here, when you combine those questions with the rest of the division, it becomes a chess match of how do you best compete with what the Jaguars are doing, what the Texans are doing, and I guess to a lesser extent, what the Titans are doing. Long-winded way of asking, if the argument is, well, Latu's going to disrupt things and he's going to be a game wrecker to be able to slow down Stroud and Lawrence, what is a fair expectation for his rookie season? Should it be looking at Aiden Hutchinson when he was drafted by the Lions at 2 a couple years ago? And okay, 9.5 sacks, he needs to disrupt things, he's going to be an animal out of the gate. What is a fair expectation year one when other teams around the division are clearly better than you are?
Well, first, I would say it's kind of wild to think about how, I don't know, inept is probably too strong of a word, but just kind of shocking to think back to Robert Mathis leading the league in sacks in 2013. And since that season, over a decade ago, you've only had two players have a double-digit sack season. And it's not like 10 sacks is some just, oh my gosh, astronomical number. I mean, you're talking a little bit over, you know, a sack every other game. So it's crazy. Eric Walden and Justin Houston, and they, you know, were kind of even barely over that 10 sack number. So obviously those are two free agent acquisitions. So nobody you've drafted has reached that mark. So I guess I start there with expectations. Having said that, and I wouldn't say this, I mean, hell, I thought about this driving to the complex last night. I was like, man, you look back on the 15th overall picks, because I think we always do this with the draft. The draft happens Thursday night, and immediately on Friday, you talk about the player like he's going to be a Pro Bowler right away. And it's like, well, that's not really how it typically happens. But for me, I have a really high bar for Latu next year, and I think you need to have that. If you have long-term medical concerns, which I don't think the Colts do, but let's, you know, maybe live in a little bit of reality of, you know, if the guy's playing a violent sport of the NFL and he's got these neck issues, I don't think chalking him up to a 10-year career right away is probably the safest bet. So if you think there's going to be some whatever debilitation there that, you know, shortens his career, then you better get the early return on it. And again, Chris Ballard thinks there will be that. So I don't know, Jimmy, to throw out a number, I mean, certainly you'd like to, you know, be right around that double-digit number. But more than anything, and I know some gray area gets involved in it, you just need the timely, closing, consistent moments. You haven't had that. I mean, you bring up C.J. Stroud in Houston. I mean, if you would have gotten a stop on 2nd and 20 or 2nd and 14 or 2nd and 13 on that eventual game-winning drive, who knows how that season finale goes. We focus so much on, you know, Nico Collins on the first play or, you know, the 4th-and-1 to Tyler Goodson, but they just have not had a closer off the edge. And obviously, you know, Jake knows this full well, what Freeney and Mathis did. If Latu can give you, you know, a fraction of that, that would be massive, because too often, especially at home, weirdly enough, this team has had fourth quarter leads and opposing quarterbacks, and frankly, some bad quarterbacks have just gone right down the field against you and scored the eventual game-winning touchdown. That stuff can't happen.
Kevin, my larger issue or concern is that I felt like over the years, maybe not just with the Colts, but around the league, there is more margin for error for a rookie corner, and it's easier for cornerbacks to shine at times based on what's being asked of them than it is a rookie edge rusher who all of a sudden is going against, like, sure, maybe he has a nice build in college, but you're going against grown-ass men in the trenches that are able to swat away 10-year veterans like flies sometimes. So I guess I didn't mean to ask that, like, what's a fair number for him, but is it fair to expect him to perform the way, when he was healthy, Juju Brents did last year? Like, is it fair to expect him to be high-level impact at his job right away, or is he going to have, and it, does he have enough margin of error for that to be acceptable, struggles that often happens when you're in the trenches suddenly going against somebody that's been doing it for 5 years that has 80, 90 pounds on you?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is going to be a learning curve and a challenge to that. Yeah, I don't want to act like he just walks in and becomes a Pro Bowler, but, you know, there are some advantages that he also will have around him, and obviously he didn't have the UCLA. I would assume the UCLA, he was viewed as the guy to try and limit and slow down on a consistent basis. You know, he will have DeForest Buckner next to him on a lot of rushing downs. And I think also a couple things that stand out to him is, like, you know, this is not some fast dude who played at nothing against Ball State, great school, produced my mom, shout out Colleen Bowen, chirp chirp. But this is not some speed rusher at Ball State that just went by the MAC offensive tackles with speed, you know, 95% of the time. This is a dude that played in the Pac-12, has a variety of pass rush moves by many accounts. Hell, just watch his sack highlight film, you'll see that. And he lines up in different spots. You know, one thing about Quiddy Pay, you know, he really is only opposite that right tackle, whereas Latu, again, has some history at really both of those sides. So that's where I do think you have polish, you have some advancement that's different than some of these guys. Again, it's still a jump, no questions asked, but I think there is some backing and some reason behind why you could get a little bit more out of him day one than you would most of these guys.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Kevin Bowen is our guest. You hear him in the mornings on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy talking about the Colts. You know, aside from the Colts pick last night, Kevin, was there anything? I mean, Michael Penix Jr. was the big shocker, no question about that. So I'll take that obvious answer off the board. Anything else about the draft that just kind of jumped out at you or went in defiance of what was anticipated going in?
Well, I mean, I can't stress the Penix thing enough. I mean, I just... Someone explained it to me. I mean, to pay Cousins that money, and it's not like Penix is a project. I mean, Penix is, you know, what? He's got to be one of the oldest prospects in the entire draft. And, you know, he's going to sit till he's 27 or 28, and that's the eighth overall pick when you seemingly probably could have traded back and still got him. I don't totally get the Raiders going Brock Bowers a year after Michael Mayer, I thought was interesting. You know, the Colts could see, I guess, three rookie QBs. I believe I had that right on the schedule. Caleb Williams would be here. J.J. McCarthy with the Vikings. Drake May with the Patriots to be on the road. And then I think you might have had him pegged, Jake. I know Andy was a big fan of him. You know, Brian Thomas Jr., a lot of people who thought the Colts could be there at 15 and take him. He ends up going to Jacksonville, ironically, and Jacksonville trades back and gets him. So that'll be something to keep an eye on. But, I mean, certainly the offense, you know, most offensive picks ever in round one, 19 is a previous record, 23 was that record. And just the shocking nature to, I mean, the Colts at 15 getting the first defensive player off the board. It's just wild.
There was no guarantee that he was going to fall anyway, but so what happens with the tight end room now? I don't blame Ballard for this. Like, it is what it is. I think that I fully believe the Raiders were interested in Penix, and seeing him go where he did, they have to pick something there if they're not going to trade back. And, like, two tight end sets with Mayer and Bowers in a couple years could be pretty dangerous, depending on the quarterback. Getting back to the Colts, though, sorry for the diatribe there. Where do you see the tight end room now? Is it Jelani Woods' room? Are we back to just, hey, situational tight ends and guys are going to play in different snap counts based on scheme, based on situation? What happens now there?
Yeah, I think it's probably that. And, you know, I had heard some whispers about, you know, Bowers and the Colts' interest being there, and especially with Shane Steichen. And, you know, I think you go back and you listen to Ballard and Steichen throughout the offseason, I do think, you know, Steichen at times spoke of, you know, wanting that type of tight end, whereas Ballard, and I guess part of it is Ballard drafted that room, he's a little bit more content with what they have in there. So, I think it'll be kind of a by-committee sort of feel to it, which I know is not sexy and it's not flashy and it doesn't really scare anybody, but I think that's just the reality of what the tight end room is going to look like this year, and kind of see how it'll evolve there. I wouldn't see them just throwing another middle round, you know, pick at it like they have in recent drafts. I think this is probably the group, especially with Drew Ogletree back.
Okay, Kevin, you know, the greedy question that everybody's going to have now, they have selected in round number one. Where do the Colts go now, round number two?
Yeah, I think it's got to be wide out. And then I guess you go corner or safety. I could see Ballard, O-line, or even linebacker today. You know, I know he loves the O-line draft class here. I think you could wait maybe even till round four, but you got to get into this wideout depth at some point. And, you know, again, this goes back to Jimmy's point about, you know, maybe the missed opportunity, and maybe I'm getting too greedy, but, you know, I tweeted out yesterday, I got two goals for the Colts in this draft. One is a Pro Bowl defender at a position that matters, pass rusher. And then the other would be to find a pass catcher that, you know, grows into the prime years of Anthony Richardson. And, you know, Michael Pittman Jr., his contract is actually going to come up before Richardson comes up. So, you know, there's a good chance it's not Pittman that's, you know, around when Richardson's, what, 25 or 26. So I think that the goal would be to try to hit at both of those areas. Again, it's a little greedy, but I think to do that, this is kind of the route you had to go. You had to go, you know, defensive guy first and then that wide out depth, because this position in wide receiver has proven in recent years to be one where there are ample second, third, fourth round hits, you know, throughout recent drafts. I mean, hell, look at the two guys that got paid last night, A.J. Brown and Amon-Ra St. Brown, both of them outside of round one. You know, again, Terry McLaurin, DK Metcalf, we do this exercise endlessly, Deebo Samuel. There are plenty of guys that are out of round one that can be hits. So I think that's where you have to go probably here round two tonight.
Do you think Kevin Bowen is our guest? You can hear him on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy, 7 to 10 a.m. on these airwaves. Of course, find his work on 107.5thefan.com. Do you think that based on what's available at corner still and the idea, and I don't know that I believe they're going to do this or not, but you know, I talked about it with Eddie earlier in the show about like the veteran market. Do you think that they have enough confidence in either the veteran market or what's left on the draft boards to get a corner that can compete with what else is happening in the AFC South? Because I'm with you, Latu, it shouldn't be, hey, he's going to be an all-pro edge rusher right out of the gate, but you know, certainly he'll make an impact. You would think, though, pass rushers have more time to get to the quarterback inherently, as you know, if you have corners that are able to slow things down over the top. So in day two and day three, where is their value still at corner for them, or are they going to be forced to go get a veteran? Or C, I guess, is that room really as good as Ballard said it was a week ago, and they're not really concerned about addressing it?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, part of me thinks that last point you made, Jimmy, kind of runs supreme in Chris Ballard's mind.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm falling a little bit into the trap of, you know, what he said last Friday, which again turned into action last night with, you know, substance on film more than just these crazy elite traits like they have typically gone. But I didn't hear an urgent answer in regards to DB last Friday at all. And through one round of the draft, that holds true with the best corner.
You could have, right? I mean, yeah, you had them both there.
He could have got his pick of the litter there. So, and you know, again, I've got reservations about that. And I think Joel Erickson has used this phrase often in talking about, you know, raising the floor of that group with a veteran. And we'll see what happens after the draft if you can find someone. But I think it's definitely an area to explore. I mean, in terms of the AFC South, I don't think there's a more volatile team than the Colts because of Richardson. You know, I think for the most part, you kind of know what Houston is and can be. You kind of know what Jacksonville is and can be. I don't feel that way about the Colts. I mean, I think if Richardson hits, you could have a division champ, quite possibly. But if he doesn't, or there's inconsistencies, or he gets hurt, then, you know, maybe you're a team that's much, much closer to, you know, whatever, a 7-win football team or something along those lines. Whereas, again, with Houston and Jacksonville, I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about injuries to their quarterback, but I don't know, just the style of their quarterbacks, they're not as prone to some of that I think Richardson is. So, boy, it's just time to make the playoffs. Like, I know that's just kind of a random thought to throw out there, but, you know, the league expanding playoffs a few years ago, it's like, you know, I mean, almost half the AFC, 7 of the 16 teams make the playoffs. And, you know, for you to, you know, possibly go down that path again, I mean, that's why I think the seat needs to be scorching hot for Chris Ballard entering this year.
Kevin, do the Pacers get it done tonight? Or this afternoon, I guess I'd say.
I think they do. Actually, I was coming back from grabbing a bite to eat, and I got to my car in the garage and ran into the Halliburton parents clad in their Pacers gear. So they are ready for tonight. Yeah, I do. I'm a little, like, it's kind of the point where those...
Are they aware of your crush on Ben Mathurin?
I don't believe so. They were very receptive of me saying hello, and I just said good luck. I didn't get a restraining order vibe or anything like that.
That's good.
Uh, from them. So, yeah, I guess I can sleep well tonight. This is a little Jimmy Cookish of me, but the line is growing, and it's getting very big, and I'm a little, like, uneasy about that.
Well, the line is being estimated by the people that said the attendance last night at the NFL draft.
Oh gosh, I forgot that you'd probably
It's he gave himself lasted 24 minutes before he brought it up.
Kevin, I'm just gonna say this once, okay, Kevin, just once, and then you have to agree with me, and then we move on, okay? 275,000, come on.
It looked like a big crowd.
Okay, I don't dispute that. That's to me what's amazing. It looked like probably 50 to 60,000 people, no question. I don't think people realize how many people 275,000 people is.
Sure, especially in that confined of a space.
Correct.
I will just add this, and this is not what you're asking. And look, those people out there last night, they are the reason that us three have jobs. So I probably shouldn't say this. But I can't think of anything worse than standing in that crowd listening to names be called for 4 hours.
The only thing I could think worse would be being in Times Square in New York City and waiting 4 hours for a 60-second countdown in 10-degree weather. That's the only thing I could think worse.
My aunt lives an hour north of New York City, and she did it once, and she said it was the dumbest mistake of her life.
I've never met anybody that's done that twice, right?
Yeah.
Back to the game, though. So no Giannis tonight. We know that for a fact, right? And Middleton's questionable, right?
Right, and I just think calling them the others is probably not fair. I just think your others play better at home. Like Neesmith and Toppin, they didn't shoot it great in Milwaukee. They've shot it pretty well, especially Neesmith this season. I just think they'll shoot it better. And, I mean, God, I love Pat Connaughton, but he's not going to hit 4 or 5 threes tonight. Like I just don't see – if Middleton is limited in any way and or doesn't play, boy, I think the Pacers could win this going away. Yeah, I mean, even more attention goes to Lillard. And now Neesmith doesn't have to guard, you know, Middleton as tightly. So, yeah, I feel very confident. It'll be rocking. I can't wait for that. What a great day. I mean, literally, just walking downtown. I mean, you're already seeing a bunch of people in Pacers gear. It's awesome. I kind of forgot what that feeling was like.
Kevin, the Australians are here. The Australians are here. So what more do you want, right?
Oh, Michael's in the building tonight?
Michael's in the building here. He's going to be on with us in a couple minutes, I think.
Let's go. You give Michael my best.
Hey, I will.
Kevin, do me one favor, though, just for the audience and those parties that are curious. You were on scene for Ballard's press conference last night. I was still awake. I looked at the timestamp. It's like 12:15, 12:30. I don't know what time you got out of there. But then we're up for the wake-up call, up and at him early. Where is the window for your nap before the game tonight? I'm not trying to call you an old man. I'm just saying I would need one, too, if I was running through as much as you were yesterday.
Yeah, we're going to try and sneak one in here in a few. I'm not a great napper during the day, but it is a must because, unfortunately, tonight is going to be another late one. So, yeah, sound machine on. I feel like a baby. But
you're probably liking that 5:30 tip then with not just staying up so late.
No, I actually do, which, again, I mean, I know the guy's been busy with quite the news dump yesterday, but can we get the letter from Hogsett, allow all the businesses out by about 3 o'clock today? I feel like we need one of those on a day like today.
Let's go. All right, Kevin, enjoy it. And I know plenty of content Monday morning. You and Andy will be breaking down what the Colts do between now and then, as well as Pacers-Bucks. Hopefully a Pacers 3-1 lead on Monday, but we shall see. A lot to be done with that. But appreciate the time. Enjoy the weekend.
See you, boys. Shout out to Michael.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
If you're just joining us, where have you been? We talked a lot in the first couple of hours, sorry, Eddie, about the Colts draft pick. And then we just had the drop by from my buddy Michael in Australia, who has become a recurring character of the program.
They were awesome.
Great guys. And they brought by, as you can tell, and Todd Meyer gets mad when we eat on the air. We did not eat on the air, but those shapes, which are the small crackers that have a sprinkle of Vegemite powder on them. Like I said, you take the first bite, you're like, yeah. And then, Eddie, your thoughts after you had a small handful?
I think they're better than the shrimp chips, but not whatever that first treat was that you gave us. I can't remember.
That's the white chocolate Tim Tams that Jimmy has now taken as his own. You guys...
I took three, Eddie, and you can disperse the rest.
Eddie, there's the rest of the Australian white chocolate Tim Tams.
I liken them a little bit. I don't know what the brand was on the Vegemite cheese chip cracker things, but they taste kind of like Cheez Nips. Mm-hmm. Again, I want to clarify that. They discontinued them apparently a couple years ago. Not Cheez-Its. There's a distinct flavor difference with Cheez Nips from Kraft. Used to be around when I was a kid, when you were a kid as well. It's similar to that in terms
you're talking about me or Jake?
Well, both of us. They were founded in 1955, but they discontinued, I guess, 4 years ago. I didn't know that. RIP Cheez Nips. Sorry about you.
joining us down the program, and I'm sure thrilled to be doing so amidst this conversation, talking about the Pacers and the Bucks. Game number three. You see his work with WTHR, Forbes, SI, notably. Tony East joins us. Tony, you are where in terms of preparation for this odd 5:30 as opposed to 7:30 start? You on your way to the field house?
I'm already downtown. Yeah, I went down early to watch him set up some shirts and get the field house prepped for the gold out. I think that, I might be wrong here, but I think their first game with shirts for fans since Victor Oladipo's injury return in 2019.
Okay, thanks.
So
that's good.
Cool to see all that.
Well, thank you. There we go. All right. Blame Tony East. I'm going to begin with this, Tony. I heard Chris Denari say something yesterday that I thought was very interesting, I believe on these airwaves, when he was saying that oftentimes the advantage goes to the team that's coming off a loss because they then make the first move in terms of adjustments, and the team that is coming off the win has more tendency to kind of stay put and as a result are a little more predictable in the next game. Do we see different looks tonight from Indiana than we saw from what clearly worked in game number two?
I absolutely think Chris is correct in that, first of all. Like, the pressure's on when you lose a game. You feel, like, more natural, like you have to do something about it. And the other team, I think, naturally thinks, well, what we just did worked. You know, let's keep doing that. We got this. So I think that after a win, that's just natural thinking. And so for the Pacers, being proactive, right? I asked Rick Carlisle about that before. Game two, like, how do you as a coach work through adjustments with your team while also considering what the Bucks could do to adjust even after the Bucks won game one? So I think that's an interesting dynamic of the playoffs in general. And so for the Pacers, you know, it's like, what are the Bucks going to do to try to counteract the pace that, you know, clearly overwhelmed them somewhat in game two, right? The Pacers 48 minutes were playing at the speed they wanted. They were doing that thing I always talk about where they rush out of bounds to grab the ball. They were great in transition. You know, they, every time they noticed that for some reason, Bobby Portis or Brook Lopez fell on their butt. They were running. Like, it's, that's when the Pacers were at their best. And what do the Bucks do about that, right? Are they better on the glass? Are they better in transition defense? Do they prioritize something else offensively so it's easier for them to get back and have the right matchups? I don't know. That's something I think that they'll have to look out for, and the Pacers need to figure out what they can do about it. And what other looks can the Bucks throw defensively at Siakam is obviously going to be a big question after his unbelievable first two games. And if they do send two to him all of a sudden, what are the Pacers ready for? Can they get Tyrese Haliburton going? Is Miles Turner suddenly way more important because he'll have more easy looks if the front court coverage is shifted to Siakam? That's the kind of stuff I think the Pacers need to be ready for from the Bucks tonight.
Tony East, nice enough to take some time with us. You find his work on Sports Illustrated covering the Pacers there, as well as the Locked On Pacers, as the Locked On Podcast Network continues to thrive throughout the basketball landscape. Tony, for the Pacers, you mention where the Bucks adjust and the double teams that could, instead of being sent towards Tyrese Haliburton or instead of sent to whoever is the guard, you know, with it off ball, where will the defensive adjustments occur in your mind? If it does happen where they're sending doubles to Siakam for Tyrese Haliburton, does that then open the door specifically for him? Like, we've had a debate on this show the last couple of days and in times off air as well. Does Tyrese have within his arsenal the ability to create his own shot regularly, even if he's getting double teamed? And if the answer to that question is no, then does it suddenly become green flag racing for him if double teams are sent towards Siakam?
Yeah, it's kind of twofold, right? Like, the other thing Tyrese was talking about after game two was, and I thought this could be a storyline in the series, matching a band in the front court, which basically just means their five was guarding the four and the four was guarding the five. So sometimes Portis was on Turner and Brook Lopez was on Siakam. The reason being, or partly, is now Brook Lopez, if Siakam setting a bunch of screens, is involved in that action. He's a very good defender. So what if they switch that back so that someone more mobile like Portis can be on Siakam and then it's easier to send two to him? Well, the first thing you do if you're the Pacers is suddenly Miles Turner setting a bunch of screens instead of Siakam so he can get into space so he can, you know, start attacking the basket more. And he was much better at that in game two than he was in game one. But for Haliburton specifically, you know, they've been doubling him already. And what's been interesting, looking at the stats, like Halpern's passing like crazy. Like him and Jokic are like dozens of passes per game above anyone else in the postseason so far. So he's clearly trying to make the right plays and making it work. So if they have to ease off of that in any way to cover Siakam, I'll be curious what level he can get to as a scorer. Right? He's not driving nearly as much to the basket as he was in the regular season. I think part of that's because of the way the Bucks are defending him. He clearly can't get as many shots up, like 17 total in two games. I think that a lot of that is, again, because of the way he's being covered and not anything about him being far too passive, a little bit certainly in game one. So if he is eased up on coverages, as things shift more towards Pascal, for example, or if the matchups change in the front court, I think that's where he can kind of find a way to ignite himself and get going, because that's the next step for the Pacers. Is, you know, if he's the 20-10 guy he was in the regular season on top of what they're getting from their front court, they'll look really potent on the offensive end.
Tony, do you believe that Tyrese Haliburton is a natural scorer who has the ability to facilitate, or a natural facilitator who has the ability to score?
I think he's a natural facilitator, certainly. I mean, you can see every time he gets the ball, what's the first thing he does? It's not look at the rim. It's turn his head up the court and look where all his teammates are and look where the defense is to see what he can, you know, very quickly try to get to. And I think that's fine. The natural facilitators can be good. This year he became more – you can't be naturally two things, right? But, like, he became more willing to take the shot himself. I think you realize that, especially in the first 3 months of the season when he was a top whatever number, that small player you pick in the league, that him shooting himself or creating the shot for himself was one of the most efficient things the Pacers could do on a given possession. So he was willing to take those. And, you know, as his efficiency kind of waned, I think he went away from that, which was the correct thing to do. But at some point, he'll have to get back to that level of not being a natural scorer, but at least looking to it more if the Bucks ease up on him to try to stop other stuff. But to answer the question directly, yeah, I think he's certainly more of a natural playmaker, and you can just see that in his little tendencies the second he catches the ball every time.
Are we locked at this stage from a rotation standpoint to an 8-man rotation, barring foul trouble? Like, I get it, sometimes players get in foul trouble, and then maybe that opens the door for more Jalen Smith or more Isaiah Jackson or wherever you want to go. But in terms of what worked in game two, adjustments aside, did we learn 8-man rotation is the best play, or is there still room for extended minutes, or I guess any minutes thrown towards Jalen Smith that aren't just because of foul trouble?
Yeah, I think that they'll stick with 8 for now to me. That was one of the adjustments they made in game two that I'll be curious about the lasting effects of, though, is it's not just that they just excised Jalen Smith, right, to do that. They had to go small a lot, right? They had a lot of time with the top in Siakam front court. That's been pretty good throughout the regular season at times, but they didn't get to it a ton because Smith was pretty good at times, and Isaiah Jackson was good, right? And so they needed to do what they did. And then in game two, they immediately went away from it, and the Bucks were going zone at the time, so it wasn't easy to assess that. But if Toppin plus Siakam continues to be a viable front court option, the Bucks aren't playing a backup center, right? Bobby Portis is their backup five, and he's kind of a four. So it's kind of what the Bucks are doing that's allowing them to do so. And I don't think the Bucks necessarily have a good choice for like an actual true five that would make the Pacers consider switching this up. So I think both because of the way the Bucks are playing and because that was more effective than anything that happened in game one, until the Bucks force the Pacers to go deeper with Smith or Jackson, I think they'll stick with the 8 you saw last game with, you know, the trickier part of that to me is the 8th guy is a rookie, right? If Ben Shepherd can be consistent, like he was very good in game 2, then I think they'll definitely stick with the 8 they have. If he's wobbly and you can expect rookies to have ups and downs in a postseason setting, then maybe they have to consider at least where the minutes are being allocated or who the 8th guy is or something like that.
How would you slow down Siakam if you were game planning against him with the Bucks roster? And do they have the components, whether it's double teams like we mentioned, whether it's different looks, do they have the components to hope to slow him down without Giannis on the floor?
Yeah, I would study like rain dances from the 1000s and, you know, some sort of ritualistic thing to do. I mean, he's just, everything he's doing is working. And the thing about the Bucks that it's only kind of a critique, but it really looks obvious without Giannis, is the word I keep using is creaky, right? They're just kind of like older and slower. And so Siakam, when he gets a switch to a smaller guard, easy basket. If he catches it with any momentum, he's blown by somebody. Like, it's been so easy for him to get where he wants to go and get the shot he wants. And of course it's easy to score when you make over 60 or 70% of your shots in a game. So maybe that's what they do, is pray that it drops to 50% or something. That's still good, but less crazy. But they have to try to adjust in some way, whether that's putting Chris Middleton on him even, or, you know, trying to shade him with two guys off the ball so he can't catch as much. And that means someone else will be open or have opportunities for the Pacers, because they don't have a good matchup for him from a size and speed perspective on their roster, I think. And, well, they do. He's just out with a calf injury and not playing again tonight. So in the absence of Giannis, I think they have to send at least two to him to cut off his space, because he's got an advantage over basically every guy that they can put on him.
How many games, Tony, realistically in this series? And I know that this depends on, you know, where the series goes, but how many games do you realistically think more beyond today Giannis misses?
Oh, that's a good question. So I keep using this analog, and I understand why it might be a poor analog, but Doug McDermott in the season for the Pacers had a calf injury. He played on February 26th, and then he did not play again until March 20th. That's 23 days. And I only bring that up because after he returned in Detroit, I asked him about it, and he said it was a 2 to 4 week injury, and he came back barely over three. And so the reason I think that's relevant is because Giannis' injury has been described 2 to 4 weeks. So I don't know that they're the same injury. I don't know if they're the same severity. I don't know that. So that's where their caveats come from. And everybody who reports on the Bucks has said, you know, Giannis has the superhuman healing and all that. But if it's about the same timeline that can be expected of a 30-ish-year-old player recovering from a calf injury, 3 weeks from the injury would be exactly game five next Tuesday. So perhaps Giannis is the fast healer that he's been described to be, and he has been in the past. If people remember the Bucks-Hawks series in 2021, his knee bent the wrong way, and he played in the very next game, right? It was unbelievable. So maybe he can heal faster and play in game four. Maybe it's a three-week thing and he plays in game five. But, you know, a 2 to 4 week thing, like, could last longer than that. So I am guessing, but my operating assumption before the series was maybe game three was in play. That's tonight. That's clearly not happening. So now I'm kind of thinking, okay, maybe 3 weeks, maybe game five at home is the target for the Bucks. But also, it depends on how tonight goes. If they win, maybe they can afford to be a little more cautious.
How much does strategy and pressure and the element of game planning for Milwaukee change, both as a cautionary tale, but also inherently as a benefit change for the Pacers game planning for Milwaukee, I beg your pardon, if Chris Middleton misses tonight?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's everything, right? Like, he's the only other guy who has, like, a lot of juice this series in terms of scoring and passing threat. Like, Patrick Beverley had 8 assists in game one, I think, and Portis can certainly score sometimes. We've seen Brook Lopez in the first half of game two be a crazy great shooter, right? And that's all good and useful and has helped the Bucks. But Chris Middleton had good passing and scoring game in game one and was decent at both in game two, although he got hurt in that game, right? If he's not playing, it's all Dame. Like, Dame is their only source of, like, consistent bothness on the offensive end. And even he hasn't been that effective of a creator for others in the series, and that's been fine. That's not a critique of him. He's been unbelievable. So I think without him, I mean, their offense will just be so limited. It's Dame, and then, you know, maybe Bobby Portis has mismatches he can punish throughout a game, which he has in the series so far, and I guess Lopez pick and pops will be there as long as Dame is playing, but it's just going to be so hard for them to manufacture good offense. And really, like, I guess if the Pacers stunk so much on offense in game one that it didn't feel this way, but the Pacers have held them under 110 both games. They haven't been terrible on defense. So you take away one of the Bucks' biggest threats, I mean, that changes a lot of what the Pacers can do defensively, and it'll make it easier for them to run. So I just, that's if he doesn't play, that's huge, I think, for this game.
What are the odds Bobby Portis tonight starts a scuffle?
It depends on the score at halftime, I would say. If the Pacers come out and they're up big early, I think it'd be pretty high. I mean, there's been kind of like a scuffle every game already, although neither of them have been particularly significant or have had any sort of bearing on the rest of the game or the rest of the series. But, yeah, the Bucks might need that little kick in the teeth if they're getting their butt kicked in the first half of this game.
Tony, in your opinion, Tony East is our guest joining us on the program on the always busy, shockingly unsponsored guest line here on Query & Company. Tony, if in your opinion, through two games, which team is more prone to make in-game adjustments and pull away from what they're doing and go with different looks? Or is that necessitated by the flow of the game? Which of the two do you think is more prone to do that?
Yeah, I think that your second part of that question is extremely important, that it's the game flow has really dictated that. Like, the Pacers were more adjusty. That's not a word, but now it is. In game one, and the Bucks certainly were in game two. But I think the reason I'm saying the Bucks is my answer is because, again, to use the word familiar, their creakiness kind of means that, like, they don't have as much, like, 48-minute full-force potential. And I always say I'm a little bit guessing with this, but it's kind of obvious when you watch, like, in the second half of game two, they just stuck Dame in the corner a lot. And I think that's because he's exhausted. Like, he dealt with a lot of injuries this season. He turns 34 later this year. Like, to do what he does in these first halves, it's very exhausting. It's hard to do that for a full game, and that forces them to play differently at times. Like, you could just look at the stats. He has 69 points through two games. 61 of them are in the first half, right? Like, it's so hard to do that for a full game. And some of that is the Pacers' adjustments, but some of it's that he's in the corner, and that just naturally changes the way that they play, and the Pacers have been better in the second half of both games. So I think that forces the Bucks to adjust somewhat, and they're very limited in shot creation and scoring punch otherwise. So, you know, I because of the pace the Pacers can play at, and they're a little more versatile offensively, I think the Bucks have to adjust more in games. Not that it's good or bad to be doing that, but I think that it's just generally, like, if you're the team that's down or the game flow hasn't favored you in the first half of these games, that team will be the team that is more desperate to change something or search for an answer in the second half, and that's happened in both these games so far.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Tony East is our guest. You can find his work on SI.com covering the Pacers as well as host of the Locked On Pacers podcast. Tony, Jake asked you earlier if you thought that Tyrese was a, you know, natural passer and, you know, a gifted scorer, or a gifted scorer, a natural passer. And you went what a lot of people, I think when they view his game, which is that he's a passer first. That's his best gift, but he is capable of scoring as well. There's another conversation that I've had in the last couple of days and weeks. When you look at Tyrese Halliburton, you look back at what he did during the regular season, especially that stretch run. And I know it was early in the season, but it looked like he was capable of creating his own shot at will, of getting to the rim, of knifing through defenses and having different looks, not just his slightly delayed three-pointer. Like, he had many options within his arsenal to go score. Was that because it's the regular season, or can we not judge him and his ability to potentially be a playoff scorer just on this one series because of how he's being defended?
Yeah, I think how he's being defended is really clouding what people are making of his production. Like, I was digging into Andrew Nembhard's stats today, and to get this to Halliburton, like, Andrew Nembhard is, I think, second or third on the team in drives per game in this series. Pascal's first, TJ second. Tyrese is, like, fifth or sixth. And that's not because he's not capable of it, because even in the second half of the regular season when he was, you know, not the same player and everybody was making a lot of his stats and slumping from shooting and all that, he was getting to the rim, like, a lot in those games. And that was when he was really at his best, is when he could, you know, have a game where he'd only take three or four threes but still have 20 and 10 because he could get in the lane and pass and finish at the rim and all that. The Bucks do not want him to do that, right? When he makes defense bend or rotate or whatever, he's throwing a dart of a pass or he's hitting a floater. Like, he still shot, like, 60% from two after the All-Star break, and his drive numbers are massive. And so that's what the Bucks, I think, have been particularly trying to do with their game plan against him, with multiple guys or bringing someone up, whatever, is not let him get to the rim. And that's going to limit a lot of what he does. Like, even in the second game when he was more aggressive, he only took 10 shots. So I think that is very specific from the Bucks to cut off. And Halliburton, even if he's not the same level of shooter as he was early in the season for whatever reason, he still is so good in that area. The Pacers say paint to great all the time. He's so good in that area. If they cut that off, it makes him look bad, but he's passing a ton. Other guys look good. You know, maybe if they continue to look like they did in game two, their offense can be just as good even if they defend him in that way. His on-off numbers are still terrific, right? He was plus a bunch in game two. So maybe it's a game plan other teams can follow and try to do, but it's, you know, and I think at some point against better opponents, he'll have to be more of a scorer than this. But in the current setup and given the current Bucks defensive scheme, like, I think they're just really cutting off his drive, and that's made him have at least different stats, but still be just as impactful.
Tony East is our guest. Did we lose Tony?
Tony still got us?
I think so.
There we go. Now we got him. Tony, did you ever watch Ted Lasso?
I did not watch Ted Lasso. I don't have what it's on. Which one is it on?
Apple TV. Apple TV Plus.
I don't have
it. And I understand that. I mean, there are so many apps now, right, that you're like, wait, which one's that? Okay, so in Ted Lasso, though, there's one episode, and I'm going to give a spoiler alert for those that have not yet watched it. Great show. But there was one show where it centers the entire show around a night out for one of the auxiliary characters, Coach Beard, and it was terrible. It was the worst episode in the history of television. It had nothing to do with the rest of the show. It angered everyone. And as I was watching it, like 5 minutes into it, I'm like, well, this seems different. And then 10 minutes into it, I'm like, this is surely going to get good here in a minute. And then after 15 minutes, I was throwing things, okay? This episode number 3 of this series, tell me a storyline that you have seen hints of before that if it's happening in this game, if it doesn't correct itself within 10 or 15 minutes, it's a sign the Pacers are in trouble.
Their bench. I mean, the bench, for sure. You know, game one, and here's the thing about the Pacers second, you know, like, I kind of get what Carlisle was doing going with that group. It was so good in the regular season. It did not do well in game one. And so I still think, like, what we've seen so far in the series, Toppin had a good first half of game two, but not very good in the second half. Ben Shepherd's a rookie and had a great game two and looked like Julius Erving for 2 seconds on a reverse layup, but is a rookie. Like, you just never know what you're getting from them in the postseason. And McConnell has not been the same guy that closed the regular season. And I mostly just attribute that to, you know, when you're locked in on TJ McConnell with a game plan and you're ready for the herky jerkiness and the fadeaway 8-footer and all that, it's a little easier to contain. Brook Lopez sent one of those into the third row in game one. The bench was much better in game two. Shepherd was good. Toppin's first half was good. McConnell's second half was good. That lets the Pacers have a rotation and get their guys rest. If that group is not as good again in game three, that's going to be extremely frustrating for the Pacers, because going to 8 looks great when it works. Going to 8 when the back three are not as good is really hard. You know how I know that? Because I've watched the Bucks in this series, who couldn't play Malik Beasley at all after the first quarter in game two. And Jay Crowder, I don't think, has made a shot in the series. Maybe only one. And, you know, they're really trying to figure out what to do at backup center. Like, they just haven't had it. Like, a lot of the coverage around them is like, do they play Andre Jackson? He's a rookie. Do they try to do something else with A.J. Green, who played more in game two? So the bench is it's a very subtle thing, right? They play less in the playoffs, but for the Pacers, they were so vital in the regular season that the mixing and matching has been a big part of their success with those lineups. And so in game three tonight, you'll find out pretty quickly, like, if that group is really struggling out of the gate, or some of those bench guys are not contributing to the level they did in game two, or the Bucks have better answers for them when they're in with whatever group of starters happen to be on the floor, that'll really hurt the Pacers. It changes their rotation. It changes who can play with who, what ball handlers are on the floor. And as the Bucks have also shown, if your stars get tired late in the game, it changes the way you have to play. That really hurts. So I think the bench is the thing that you'll see it quickly in the first 10 to 15 minutes, to compare this to Ted Lasso, is important. And Dig, now I have to ask, have you seen Breaking Bad and what you thought of the Fly episode?
Okay, excellent question, Tony. Thank you. And somebody roasted me last week or 2 weeks ago with Breaking Bad, because I said that I thought it went like a half a season too long. Like, I hate saying this because it was a fabulous show. I loved it. But there were the show itself, by the end of it, I was like, okay, are we still doing this? Like, can we just come to a conclusion? It went like a half season too long. But the Fly episode, very similar to the Coach Beard episode of Ted Lasso. In Ted Lasso, it turns out that there were two episodes that when they turned in the show, they were two episodes short, so they had to come up with two episodes that had nothing to do with the rest of the show, and this is one of those two, and The Fly felt that way as well, right?
You know,
I didn't think it was terrible. I didn't think The Fly episode was terrible. I get what they were doing, and I thought it illustrated properly, like, the paranoia that happens with the world they were living in.
Yes.
But, after a while, you're like, okay, I get it, right?
Well, can I give my corny, like, film critic view of that? Like, the first time I watched Breaking Bad, I was like, oh, that episode sucked. Like, nothing happened. They just did what they do in 5 minutes every other episode. And the second time through, I was like, oh, this is nice. Like, character building, relationship building. I don't know. I felt like a loser being like, wow, that was much better the second time through. I better tell everyone that every time I talk about Breaking Bad.
Well, have you watched The Wire?
I have not watched The Wire. I need to watch The Wire.
Greatest television show ever made is The Wire.
That's what I hear. I need to watch it.
Best acting, best story development, best everything about it. It is absolute best writing, for sure. It is absolutely brilliant. But season two of it is the one that when you're watching it the first time, it's pretty laborious. And then, like, once you really step back and assess it, you're like, you know what? I don't think that was that bad. And you watch it a second time, which is its own neuroticism, then you go, I get it now. So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it just sounds so, doesn't it sound so dorky? Be like, you have to watch it again. You don't know what you're talking about until you watch it twice.
Well, I mean, NBA teams do that, right? Even when they win, they got to go back and watch the film, right? Got to watch film, Jimmy.
Have to make adjustments, and sometimes, you know, watching things a second time will help you gain a different perspective than you had before. I don't think you're totally critic snobby there, Tony. Hey, do we have any idea, this is partially, you know, Eddie and I talked about it earlier off air, but do we have any idea who's revving it up tonight, and is there any chance that they pull out all the stops and it's Caitlin Clark revving it up tonight?
Yeah, we saw the video of her working out in fever facilities this week. Who knows if she's still in town? I think she's just finished school to some extent still. I don't know when Iowa graduation is, but that seems like the very much most obvious person to wrap it up for their first playoff game in a long time. But I don't know that. I have not inquired. That would be a perfect choice.
All right. I'll stay
it
tuned,
ought to be Michael from Australia.
I would support that wholeheartedly.
That's right.
And not just because he bribed me with delicious Tim Tams.
Yeah, you're about done with the Tim Tams there, right?
I'm going through them.
Tony, we appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week as we get set for, we'll see whether or not, I guess, actually, game five is when? Tuesday?
Game five is Tuesday, yeah.
The Australians going to game five also, so
it's we'll awesome.
See. All right, Tony, as a matter of fact, if you go to, are you going to game five?
I am.
Okay, if I don't get a picture, by the way, weren't you supposed to send me a picture?
I was supposed to send you a picture. Let me tell you, though, Jake, your recommendations, I won't say specifically which ones, were very popular among the media contingent that went to Indy. I don't know if you heard this.
I have not. Please enlighten me, because there's nothing I like more than hearing about my own brilliance. Go ahead.
I will tell you them via text, certainly, but a group of television crew that traveled up there had a lot of fun exploring parts of Milwaukee.
I'd like to know who.
Turnoff was having a good time, that's for sure.
Here's the thing. Tony, you have no idea how much it delights me to know that at this point, and this is actually, I think this is a huge credit to myself. I have said before, I have zero, and I'm using the word zero here, I have zero actual skill, and I'm being totally serious. And I am, at this point, I am well aware to know that I'm around at this point long enough just because I'm too old that they don't really know what to do with me. And so there is a huge thrill that I get in knowing that I've become essentially the crazy uncle for many of the younger contingencies of the local media that might want to find like hot spots of folklore and cultural reference of other cities when traveling. Now, that's a fair statement of where I sent you, correct?
Yes, it is. We the problem was Dustin and I's hotel was too far from where you suggested we go. But if we have a new lodging location for Game 5, perhaps that will change.
Did you go to the bar that I recommended? And I don't mean the Pabst. Did you go to the Pabst bar?
We walked past that one. We did not go inside.
You had specific instructions to take a picture.
We were busy. The Bucks were practicing.
You were supposed to take a picture with Dustin. Eddie, get the button ready.
I know.
With Dustin.
Dopirak. I know. Yeah. He even agreed to the arrangement, and then we didn't do it.
What about the other bar?
That was a flub. That one was traveled to, yes.
Really? The second bar? The one of cultural significance?
Yes.
And your thoughts?
Yeah. Someone thought that was it before they knew it was it, who drove past it the first time. So.
Yes.
Okay. It sounds very obvious.
Don't worry, yeah. Tony. I'll wait until you're off the air before I tell everybody what we're talking about, right?
Okay. All right. Sure it's very obvious to a lot of people, but yeah.
All right, Tony. I appreciate it. And your assignment now for Game 5 is I want a picture of you, Dustin.
Dopirak.
And then the two Australians at the PBR bar that you blew off the first time. All right.
Yeah. All right, I'll make it happen.
All right, Tony East joining us on the program.
Jake, I want you to know, I don't know if you listened on Monday, but we properly did the Dustin Dopirak bit with him. So, in your honor.
You have no idea how much that warms my heart.
Yeah, there you go.
Not as much as the fact that Tony East and the rest of the boys went to the club where Jeffrey Dahmer met his victims, but that's okay. You know, it's a whole different talk show, right?